fall down. I'd like to open the House Committee on Consumer Protection. It is Wednesday, May 23rd, 2007. Today we have a couple of bills up. We're going to start out with Senate Bill 431A. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 431A. Steve, give us a brief review of where we're at and what we're waiting for and what we hope to accomplish with this bill today.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. Senate Bill 431A prohibits a landlord from having a motor vehicle removed from a premises without notice to tenant who owns or operates the vehicle except under specified circumstances. I'd put amendments in on behalf of the coalition on midday Monday, and we haven't gotten them back yet, so we're waiting on amendments that were consensus amendments, but I think the advocates would appreciate an opportunity for them to review and explain the amendments and questions.
Great. I have on the list Sean Cruz. If you would like to come up and give us a couple of comments and answer a couple of questions, perhaps we can take care of outstanding questions that we haven't got answers to. Okay. If any.
Sure. All the members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sean Cruz, Senator Abel Gordley's Chief of Staff, and thank you for holding this second hearing on this bill. I wanted to be responsive to some of the questions that were raised by the committee in the last hearing, and also to provide a little better background on the bill than I think I did then. And what I've passed out there is two invoices. What's important about these invoices is that these are two vehicles that were towed from the same property, same time, same place, same company, and you would think that the invoices would be the same. But what we found was that there were two invoices, and the top invoice you're looking at is under City of Portland regulations. The lower invoice is unregulated. This part has been fixed in Senate Bill 116. There was a bar in ORS that prevented regulating parking facilities if they held fewer than 10 vehicles. And that is the wrinkle in the law that the patrol towers were exploiting to escape regulation. The city does not permit in the regulated invoice at the top, those are the only fees that the city permits. The ones below, you see mileage tacked on there, you see a charge for fuel that they say they burned up in their truck. There's a $10 photo fee that they would charge somebody, and so on and so forth. $4 a mile, and none of the numbers line up, neither do the line items themselves between the two invoices. They are completely different animals. And so this is when we saw this, we started wondering, well, what does this mean? Because you would never know that the problems you're exposed to depends entirely on how big the parking lot is. And so when we did the research with legislative counsel, we found that no one knew why this statute existed. No one could figure 10 was an arbitrary number. So we removed that in 116. And I'm getting to answering Representative Riley's earlier question of what constitutes a ban on patrol towing. But I wanted to provide this example of here are cars that were on private property and were towed because, as you see, they don't have a permit. No permit to park in my own driveway in this case. So I wanted to put that information out there for the committee. In 431, the language that we had in the original bill, the way a ban works is it's pretty simple and straightforward. You require the landlord, property owner, manager, or their agent to be present at the time of the tow and sign the invoice. And that eliminates all these other kind of headaches. Representative Nelson wondered if, say, you own a number of single-family homes or duplexes, how does this apply to you? And in 116, we eliminated that 10-vehicle facility rule so that the only exception is for single-family homes and duplexes, which are often owner-occupied. So the city has no power to regulate towing from single-family homes and duplexes. The state doesn't, to answer that question. And as I said before, I do not have the answer of Representative Bonamici's as to what the penalty might be for violating any of these provisions.
Thank you for that, Sean. Kind of refreshes our memory of what this conversation and bill was about. Does anybody on the committee have questions for Sean at this point?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
I want to tell Sean again that this has happened to a lot of people. Boy, once you open this, you know, suitcase of problems, everybody says, boy, I can remember, you know, and I had to pay for it myself. And just to use a personal story, twice this happened to me in one day.
Mm-hmm.
So I have great empathy for you. But I'm just curious if we're not going to put in here some type of what's the word, punishment. We probably just got it for naught. Would you recommend anything?
Chair Holy, Representative Nelson, well, I considered a tow truck demolition derby.
Oh!
That might be a fundraiser. Actually, I don't know. But also another question you had that we discussed in the earlier hearing was, what about when Mom comes over and we're talking about designated parking spots? You know, that really should be considered to be the property of the tenant if it's a designated parking spot and the tenant wants to have Mom park in his or her spot and not get towed. I've spoken about this with Sybil Hebb, who's working on the amendments with the coalition, and she thought they would find a way to address that. I don't know any more specifics about that. But another issue that we have, working with a constituent of Representative Hunt's in Gladstone, and then another constituent in West Lynn. These are both people who were longtime residents of their apartment complexes, both disabled. Everyone knew they were disabled. The management, their neighbors, and the tow company. Because they live there, the tows companies would patrol through, they would know these are their vehicles. The gentleman from West Lynn, vehicle was towed because the parking permit that he had, the tow company likes to see it up hanging from the mirror, and he had it on his dash. But they knew it was his vehicle, they knew he was disabled, and they towed it anyway. It took months for him to get a refund. There's a disabled lady in Gladstone who wrote to us, and similar situation. Everybody in the apartment complex knew she was disabled. She parked in the disabled spot where she'd always parked, and they towed her vehicle because she didn't have a permit displayed. And our conversation with the landlord was, the landlord agreed, yeah, we know she's disabled, and she was parked in where she normally does, but she didn't have a disabled permit on it. But we know she's disabled.
Jeez.
And we said, well, when are you going to give her money back? And we have not heard from them since then. So the question of what do you do is a very good one. I know that when I went to small claims court over this, and that's about a three-day enterprise, you know, going to small claims court once you get everything done, I was kind of disappointed to see that the tow truck driver wasn't there.
Why?
Because the driver, of course, in this case, would have been several drivers, were the only ones that were actually witnesses to the vehicle theft. And yet, the way the system works is they don't require the truck drivers themselves to appear personally in court. The managers go in and do that, so the truck drivers can focus on towing cars and having no repercussions personally, because they still get paid as long as they tow your car.
Could I just ask one more question, please?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Sean, this brings to mind, do they keep some kind of report of daily activities? I know when I was in the trucking business, we kept a daily log of where we went and what we did and how many miles. Are the tow truck drivers required to do that?
I believe they are, at least in the city of Portland, but I don't know beyond.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Cruz? Mr. Cruz, thank you for coming forward and giving us this additional information on Senate Bill 431.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. We're not going to open a work session or move this bill today, obviously, because we don't have the amendments that we're waiting for. So we will carry this bill over until Friday. Yes, indeed. Friday it will be, and hopefully we'll be ready to move the bill at that point. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 431. And next, I'd like to open up a public hearing for Senate Bill 523A. Steve, give us a brief summary of 523A.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. Senate Bill 523A requires an insurer, before recommending that a particular motor vehicle repair shop make repairs to the insured's vehicle, inform the insured of the insured's right to select a repair shop of the insured's choice.
Thank you. And we do have amendments on this bill, I believe.
That's correct. I believe there's dash A2 amendments.
Okay, I've got signed up Steve Morrell from State Farm for a public hearing.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, again, I'm Steve Morrell with State Farm Insurance. I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 523A as it came over from the Senate. I do oppose the dash A2 amendments. Senate Bill 523A, as it comes over from the Senate, represents a compromise between the body shop industry and the insurance industry on giving notices to people they can take their car wherever they want it repaired if we decide to give a recommendation of a repair shop. The bill as it's drafted, I think, is very close to State Farm's current practice and won't be a hard, too hard of a thing for us to implement. It'll just codify, I think, a lot of what we were doing. It gives a formal way of consumers knowing that they, if we recommend a repair shop, that that's not where they have to take the vehicle. The dash A2 amendments, as I understand them, are basically the resurrection of the total loss bill that this committee has heard before. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but I do want to kind of remind the high points of what I'm concerned about with that amendment. Basically, the way the amendment is drafted is you would throw out a number generated from a source, and you could vary up and down from that number. Current practice is to try to find out the value of the car. The suggested practice in the dash A2 amendments, in my view, sets up a dispute, and it's just not good public policy from that standpoint. It's better to try to find what the value is, explain to the customer why that's the value, and talk to them about things that you may see different on the vehicle, and that's how the current system works, which is a much better system. Also, to kind of remind the committee, when we were looking at this last time, basically the other sources you would be looking at for putting that initial value in the dash A2 amendments would be some sort of book value source that the Division of Insurance would go ahead and let us know which sources we would use. Within the different book values, as we talked about last time, even if you took NADA, for instance, there are several different distribution channels for the NADA product where the NADA book that the customer buys off the local drugstore shelf it's not the same NADA book that the car dealer is using. And also, even within the NADA website, there's B2B, business-to-business websites, and consumer websites, and you get different values. I think that if you went that direction, it would create more confusion than it clarifies. And finally, the current system may not be perfect, but I think it works extremely well. There's probably some things that can be done to help the current system. Some of those things, I've made suggestions to the insurance division when they were looking at this as far as a rulemaking process earlier this year, that I think have low downside risk of any problems, but substantial room to help things improve. So I think that the discussion could go forward in that area and maybe have some improvements, but the system as it is today works quite well. With that, I'd like to take any questions that the committee may have.
Questions from the committee. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Merrill, I'm interested in your comment that the Dash 2A2 amendment set up a dispute. I think you said process or a dispute. Because currently, it seems to me that if the customer doesn't like the evaluation, which is my understanding was the whole reason for the amendment, is that customers say, wait, they're not giving me enough for my car, then they dispute that. Are you anticipating more disputes if this is set up than under existing practice?
Chair Hovey, Representative Amish, yes, I do expect more disputes. The reason for that is we have actually over time taken a look at what book values look like compared to the values that are generated from the vendors, current vendors that we have. Globally, I think you would end up with the same amount of money being paid out by insurers. But what we noticed between the book values and the vendor values, there are some cars that have a lot more deviation as to what you would go and research the value and get down to the, you know, drill down on and find out what the value is. There's more variance when you're using the book product. So with that and putting that number out to begin with and knowing there's more variance, I think you would generate more disputes.
Thank you.
Further questions? Oh, Representative Girard, I didn't see you down there.
Thank you, Chair. I thought this was the original Bill 523, which everybody came and gave his testimony they supported. He said that was a compromise between the insurance industry and the body shops.
Chair Holy, Representative Girard, the original bill as it started out would have prohibited us from even mentioning the fact that we have repair programs. And Senator Brzezinski, as that bill was drafted, was not in favor of how that was written, and he basically worked with both sides of the issue to broker a compromise that everybody could agree with. And the bill 523A, as it sits in front of you, is a compromise that has come forward from that original bill.
Okay. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gilliam.
Do you have any family in the room?
Great uncle, isn't it?
Everybody's part of my family.
Oh, that was a good answer.
Mr.
Chairman. Steve, I'm curious. There was some discussion about the two different notices that are contained in 523, and I don't believe we have any amendments to change those notices, but we're sort of, at the end of the committee, we were sort of talking about why there was a necessity to have two different notices. Can you explain that to us just briefly?
Chair Hovey, I think what it was is that the other side of this issue, the body shop industry, not only wanted to have verbal notice, but they wanted to have something out there in writing. And that's why you ended up with the two notices. What will happen is a customer will come to you, and you will go ahead and explain your programs to them. And basically what we do today is we tell them they can take the car anywhere they want to have it repaired. But we'll share the benefits of going through a program that we have a relationship we have with the shops. At that point, we don't know if that person's going to take us up on that or if they're just going to go where they want to go. It's up to them until really the car appears at the shop. And then when the car appears at the shop, that's when the second notice would be triggered, because that's when we know they've accepted our recommendation to go to one of the recommended shops. And so what it did was it didn't require us to send a written notice to every customer up front. It narrowed that field of people down to the people that actually showed up at a shop that we had recommended.
So I'll follow up with my own question here for a minute. So the first notice on the first page of 523 is not required to be in writing?
Chair Olvin, that's my understanding. You could start out by saying verbally, you can take the car anywhere you want to under Oregon law, that just following substantially what that verbiage there lays out. And then the written notice would follow when you know that person has accepted that recommendation and actually taken it to a recommended repair facility.
So, and then the second notice is given to them in writing. But on that second notice, it doesn't have any, it doesn't say anything that they have a right to select the motor vehicle repair shop as their choice on the second notice. And why wouldn't it say that on the notice that you have in writing?
Chair Hovey, I don't have the bill in front of me. I thought it basically tracked the same way in both places, and
Well, the second notice.
It didn't tell them. That's right. It didn't tell them they'd go anywhere. What it did was, is it basically said that. I think it told them what they could expect to receive at the second shop. I don't know the difference for that. I know that language was negotiated back and forth for quite a while, and that was the compromise that finally both sides could sign off on.
That one is written.
And here. Maybe I'll just read it to you, or you can have it for yourself, or somebody else can give you a copy of that. I guess my concern is that the first notice on the first page, being not in writing, basically states Oregon law prohibits us from requiring you to get repairs to your vehicle at a particular motor vehicle repair shop. But that's done verbally, and then the one that you have in writing doesn't actually tell the... in my mind, doesn't tell the consumer that they have a right to have the motor vehicle repaired where they want to have it repaired. It just says, you know, we've recommended a shop and you've agreed to use the recommended shop. So I guess my concern there is that there's no way to approve or disprove whether or not the verbal notice got served, and it isn't contained in the written notice.
Chair, it may actually be a benefit to understand the current law. The current law requires the body shop itself to post a sign that substantially says what the first notice says, conspicuous in their place of business. So when the consumer is in there, they actually have a huge sign in front of them that says that we can't require them to take, under Oregon law, to take the vehicle to a particular shop. So that notice is in there. I think both sides of the industry know that notice is in there, and then you get the second written notice that's given to the consumer. So you will have a verbal notice. You'll actually have a very large sign, and when I say very large, I mean the letters on that sign are about this high, and it's sitting conspicuously in the repair shop's lobby area where the customers come in. Then you'll get this written notice in addition to that.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought of a question when you said that when the consumer shows up at the repair shop, then it triggers the notice. But I explained this the other day. I happen to be a heavy user of body shops for some reason that I haven't really analyzed, but it has something to do with teenagers. What if, for example, I my cars are all insured with your company. What if I take my car into my preferred body shop, which happens to be convenient to my home, and it also happens to be on your list? Do I trigger the notice? Do I get the notice or not? I just picked that one because it's one I always use because it's close to my home. And if it's on your list, you send me the notice?
Yeah.
Do you assume that I took it because you recommended it?
Yeah. Chair, Holy Representative Bonamici, in that case, we would assume that you followed up on our recommendation. And there's a communication that occurs between the shop and us at that point, and that's what would trigger that communication then. I mean, I don't see any way under the way this bill is drafted we could interpret it any other way and be safe complying with the law.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve, I'm just curious, because nowhere do we explain, is the appraiser the same as the repair shop, first of all?
Chair Holvey, Representative Nelson.
Who appraises the damage?
Yes, if you end up going to a recommended shop, what will happen is you'll go there, and while you're there, they'll go ahead and start the process of getting an estimate, and then they will give you a copy of the estimate. That's existing law and an insurance division regulation that you have to be provided with the estimate of the repairs.
So follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
So what if you know, knowing you're being a mechanic in a insurance salesman's suit, you know that that really is only a $2,000 repair, and they have got it in there for five.
Chair Hope, Representative Nelson, the shops that we have on the recommended programs, we have a process. They open themselves to audit, and we go back and reinspect. They basically write their own estimate, but we go back and reinspect to make sure that the estimates are appropriate. And a shop, in our experience, just does not take that risk that they're going to inflate the bill when they're one of our recommended repair facilities.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
But, however, Steve, the way I read this bill is I don't have to take it to one of your recommended. You can recommend them. That's great, and I appreciate it. Mm-hmm. But maybe I want to go to Gail's Body Shop.
Chair, Representative Nelson, in that case, the bill also has a provision that says if you go somewhere else that in starting line 19 of the first page, it says, if an insured elects to have a motor vehicle repaired at a motor vehicle repair shop other than the shop recommended by the insurer may not limit the cost of repairs necessary to return the motor vehicle to a pre-loss condition relative to safety, function, and appearance other than as stated in the policy or otherwise allowed by law. When we issue a contract to you with State Farm, we go ahead and say what the limit of liability is and how much we will pay. Mm-hmm. The way State Farm does it is by prevailing competitive price. Mm-hmm. And that's what the majority of the repair capacity in a particular market will charge to repair a vehicle. The way we determine that amount is we have a continuous survey with everybody that we know that is a body shop that does repairs. They have the ability to go on to our B2B website and tell us what their rates are for the various things they do. As that survey collects data, when it hits a certain point where rates go up, then that becomes the new prevailing competitive price. And it's the majority of the repair capacity. So if I have a shop that has a repair capacity of 20 versus a shop that has a repair capacity of 1, the guy with 20 repair capacity gets 20 votes as to what prevailing competitive price is, and the guy with 1 gets 1 vote.
Okay.
Further questions from the committee? Thank you very much for coming up and giving us your testimony, Mr. Merrill. Jim Marr?
Mr. Chairman? Chair Hobey, representatives of the committee, members of the committee, just wanted to thank you again for taking a look at the issue. It's an important one for consumers. As the AG said, the need for this bill is because it's a very frustrating area of the marketplace. People don't operate in it. If you're a good driver, good luck. You may never operate in it. But statistically, we'll all operate in this part of the marketplace, and it's a place where people have a lot of frustration. I'll leave it at that. To the questions today, the most important part of this bill is the notification up front when the customer or claimant first contacts the insurance company. It could be their insurance company or mine because I'm responsible for the damage. That's always, you know, I grew up in McMinnville, and the first time I had a problem, I went down and talked to the guy who sold me the policy. But that doesn't happen anymore. We all have an 800 number. If you're fortunate enough to live in a place where you know your agent, you can start there. But even that agent's going to send you to a claims number. At that point, you're on the phone, most likely, unless you go to the corporate headquarters. And that's where the notification, that's where it all happens. Now, on the back end, if you get a referral, the other part of that language, if you've received a referral, at some point, pretty quick, within 3 days, you get notified that that referral occurred. That's important now because if you get a referral, it's never written down that it occurred. When you do have problems, this ensures that the insurance company isn't going to back away from the referral if you've got problems with the repair. Now, it's not just between you and the repair shop who may be doing it to doing the repair to guidelines that they've already agreed to under a contract that the claimant did not agree to. So that back-end referral, it is important to consumers because it lets people know they're still in control. There's something in writing that happens. And, you know, this day and age, when you file an auto claim, you get written notification. You get your claim number within a couple hours because of the Internet. I mean, if you've got an email address, once you file your claim, you're going to be communicated with very quickly. Notification happens there. And to Mr. Morrow's point, What we've done is codify the best practices of the industry. We had several representatives of the industry show up on the Senate side in hearing and talk about best practices. Unfortunately, we're not protected from a company's worst practices. And we think that the best practices certainly deserve to be codified, and that's the reason for this law. And, you know, we all know that this is a product of months of negotiation, and I told you on Monday that we would have preferred something a little tougher, and I agree that the language could have been clearer, and I will point out that in the original draft of the bill, that back-end notification, I believe, is clear. This is where we ended up. So appreciate your time. I wanted to answer any questions if you had them.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Mayor, for being here. First, I want to clarify something. You said that if you're a good driver, you might be lucky and not have to visit the body shop. And I just want to clarify that my next to the last visit to the body shop had nothing to do with my driving. It was that I was hitting the parking lot. So now that that's clear, the concern that I have about the second notice is that you said that the purpose of the notice is because that's so that if the insurance company makes a referral, then they put it in writing. But when I asked Mr. Merrill, what happens if I go to somebody on your list, I choose that body shop, which I do because it's close to me, they're going to send the notice anyway. So how do you address that concern where they're sending me the notice because I'm at that body shop that happens to be on their list?
Mm-hmm.
And you said that the purpose of it is to make sure that they made a referral, but they didn't really make a referral.
It's important for people who have been referred to a shop that is under contract with an insurance company to have it in writing, representative, that the referral occurred. And without this language there it's never in writing. And that's the key part of that point. I mean, from our standpoint, notification of the law needs to occur right up front when you're making the claim and you're making that decision. And in effect, you know, there's three things that can happen here. You can choose your own body shop. You can choose to go within the preferred system that your insurer may offer, or you may make no choice. In effect, say, you guys decide. And by choosing not to decide, you have chosen, most likely, within the system that the... So, you know, while we would love to have a little bit more notification there, it's not as important for us that claimants know that ORS 3 days after the referral has occurred and the shop bought and the car may already be in the shop and torn down. It is very important, as Mr. Fuller said on Monday, right up front, that they know that they're rights. And that just goes to, I think, human nature in the marketplace. If we know we have a choice, well, we tend to make different, perhaps better informed choices in the marketplace. And the other thing I don't want to throw out there is that if you've been through this process, whether you're a member of this body or a regular person, insurance companies have an implied power over us by the fact that they can raise our rates. We know when we have a claim, those go against us and other factors. Folks who have less education, folks who are at lower income levels, tend to be more affected by steering practices, and that's just across the country. This bill is about protecting people's rights to know about a good law that we have in Oregon, and we believe that they have become better consumers with that knowledge. And I sure appreciate your time and interest to the issue.
Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you. Jim, what if that repair is up to par? What do you do? What does the insurance company do?
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously you would go back to that vendor who is the provider. Now, in a situation...
He says, I fixed it.
Yep. In a situation where the repairman says, your insurance company checked off on the repair representative, they're okay with it. They have paid us, and they checked off on the repair and told and said that we did it exactly the way they wanted it done. Now you would be left with going back to the insurance company. Of course, without any written notification, you might get into a discussion with the company. And again, it could be not your company. It could be somebody else's company. And you're stuck trying to, you know, somebody may say to you, well, why did you go there?
Exactly.
This way, at least you can say right here, you told me I went there because you recommended I went there. And it puts you in a stronger negotiating position, certainly, on getting your car fixed the way you want.
Representative Girod, question?
Yeah, I just need a little clarity on it. On the Senate Bill 523 as it came over to us, do you support the original, or do you support the dash twos, or where are you on all this? Because the question seems to be more with us on how bad the dash two is. Are you okay with the Senate Bill 523 as it came over from the Senate?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative Girod, I represent the sponsors of the bill, a coalition of consumers and body shops called Oregonians for Safe Auto Repair. We are in favor of the bill, Senate Bill 523A, as it came over to the committee. Are not taking a position on the merits of the Dash 2 amendments. However, we are certainly concerned that at this point in the process that any addition to the bill in the form of amendment certainly puts it in peril, and we know that others are that have that have participated in the bill getting to this point are also against it. And so at this point, the coalition and consumers are aligned with the insurance industry against the Dash 2 amendments. But however, you know, they look like they have some merit.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Something that you said triggered a thought in my head, which is always dangerous. But but you said that there's a notification within hours sometimes, and almost certainly there's some written notification from the insurance agent to the claimant well before any decision is made about where body shop, what body shop will be chosen. And I'm wondering why we don't have this first notice not only on the phone when you're talking, but at the first written notification, the first written contact.
The notice says...
the first notice.
The notice specifically notifying the claimant of the current statute?
Mm-hmm. I would like to see it occur sometime in written form, and just saying the first written contact would be, it seems to me, the appropriate time. Well, I don't know that I want to amend this bill, but I wanted your thoughts on that, because I may put it in next session.
Well, let me follow up with that, because that was kind of what I was getting at with the first notice being stating what their rights are under Oregon law, and the second notice being the one that they get in writing. It seems to me that that first notice ought to also be on the second notice, and they should be together before they actually accept the recommended repair shop. At that pointing out, I mean, that would be my preference too. But
Chair,
maybe somebody else can enlighten me why that isn't happening in writing the first notice. Representative Gilliam, well, you have a clarification you'd like to add or a question?
Do you know what that means?
It's a question.
Plain talk.
You made this comment earlier, so my point is I'm for more communication, so I think it's a good comment. But isn't it true that the first notice, while not being required to be writing, could be? It could be in any form. It says communicate.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean that this is, I'm not clarifying anything. It just means that it could be either one, right?
So they could be.
All right.
That's could it. Be.
I don't like
Thank that. You for that clarification.
You're welcome.
Don't like could be.
Confusing clarification.
Further, do you have a comment on that as to why the writing of the first notice isn't included on the second notice, so that when somebody's actually getting something in writing, they aren't getting that first notice maybe for the second time, but at least it's in writing before they go ahead and decide to have the repair done?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would agree with the chair, and I would just note that in the original version of the bill before it was amended, that language did exist.
In the second notice?
Yes. Looking at the first bill, it says, the first line said, we are prohibited by law from requiring that repairs be done at a specific motor vehicle shop. and then goes on to say that if you've chosen a shop under our system, you don't have, you know, it will be done. The vendor won't have to provide it at a discount rate if he doesn't have an agreement with an insurance company. I will only say that the insurance industry came back with language that deleted that line, and that was the bill that the chairman was willing to move. So, however, you know, from our standpoint, the horse is out of the barn. Once the referral's been made, notification about their right to repair or choose the repair facility is too late. As Mr. Fuller said on Monday, the only time it really matters is before you either elect to choose from the repair provider, preferred providers, elect not to choose, or say thank you very much for the information. I have a friend who doesn't happen to be on your list for whatever reason, but I'm going to go ahead and choose. Or
so you're saying the second notice, it happens after the insured has accepted to have their car fixed.
Yes.
Or you're taking it to the shop.
Right.
Okay. So which is why, Mr. Chair, I say it should be at first written contact, which may be very soon. It may be within hours.
It may not be within hours.
It may be at some later time. But there will be some written contact. There certainly will be some written contact, whether or not the shop, the recommendation is followed. Is that not? I would like to hear from the industry if that's not the case.
Mr. Merrill, please feel free to come up. And I think we've almost got a handle on this. But
well, we're getting close.
Chair Holby, Representative Riley again. Steve Merrill with State Farm Insurance. The good news for me in just sharing this with you is the service orientation of insurance companies and getting things done fast happens so quickly, and with a lot of electronic process today, that you may never have a written contact with us. You may actually have your car fixed and be very happy with a minimal amount of disruption, because what could happen is that you go and turn in a claim to your agent. He reports it to the claims office.
Mm-hmm.
We get a hold of you by telephone, make the contacts, explain your benefits to you. You go to a shop and get your car repaired. If you go to a recommended repair facility, you're going to get a lot of benefits, one of which is you're not even going to have to worry about the bill, because they're going to send us the billing for it, and they're going to get paid electronically. And basically what you'll be doing is picking up your car, and there may never be a need for us to send you any type of writing.
Interesting.
It's true.
Fascinating. It's true.
I know.
Come from our resident expert.
I've been amazed. I've worked in this industry almost all my adult life, and the improvements in service and the speed with which things happen are phenomenally good.
Well, this is good news. I'm surprised to learn this, but I think it's good news. And I'm glad you came forward to explain it to me.
Chair Holby, I might add to it, if I could. Just if you go to a recommended repair facility, one of the things you do have going is that all the insurers I'm aware of require those facilities to give you a warranty on the repairs. So if you end up with a problem, you're going to have State Farm there with you working with that shop to resolve that problem if you have a problem with repairs. And that's because we have the agreement with them. You may get a shop who works with you if you have a problem with repairs. It's not on our facility, or recommended facilities, because there are lots of good businessmen out there that will work with you. It's just that when we don't have an agreement, we don't have the same leverage to help you as we do when we have an agreement. And that's one of the benefits to using a recommended repair facility.
Thank you for
thank you very much. I appreciate
that clarification. I think we got it. Appreciate your testimony. I also have Mr. Ario. Thank you for making yourself available, Mr. Ario. You can state your name for the record. I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Joel Ario, Insurance Administrator with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm here today to answer questions on the A2 amendments. They were a set of amendments that we worked on with Representative Buckley's office. We've testified on them before. I've heard some of the preceding testimony. I'll just say two things and answer questions. One, this is a higher of consumer complaints for us, and we believe the bill does offer some new avenues for reducing the number of complaints. Secondly, we weren't involved in putting these amendments in this bill, and I hear the people talking about the bill that way, and I certainly don't want to express any opinion on the issue of whether this should be in this bill or somewhere else. I can only speak really to the merits of the A2 amendments.
Well, would you speak to the merits of the A2 amendments?
Sure. I think there are three kind of general points. I'm just trying to be careful here. There are three general points that we discussed with Representative Buckley's office that are represented in these amendments. The first is the use of a public source. You heard testimony earlier that from the industry, from Steve, that this would increase the number of consumer complaints or the number of disputes. And I think you have to look at that from two different perspectives. I think the first question is, if you have a public source that gives you one number and the insurer wants to give a higher number, I don't think anybody would suggest that would increase the number of disputes in that situation. That would be favorable to the insurer, presumably would help them solve the case easier. They would be able to say to the consumer, here's the public source number that we're required to give you by law. We want to give you a better offer than that, because this is one of those situations in which we think the public source understates the value of your car. So I don't think anybody would seriously suggest in that situation that there would be new disputes. So really what we're talking about in the concern of the insurance industry is the case where they want to give a lower number than the public source, and it's probably correct that in those cases they might have more disputes, because the consumer would say, the book value, the average value that I get off these public sources, the kind that I would use myself if I was going to sell the car, gives me a higher value than what you're willing to offer, and the insurer would have a burden there of explaining, well, your car is not actually a book value type car. It's less value than that for one reason or another. We allow them to do it, but I think it's correct. So the point there would be that the disputes will go up if the public source gives a higher number, but not if the public source gives a lower number. So that's point one. Point two on the bill is that it does provide some new consumer protections in terms of requirements of disclosing the options to the customer and also making them aware of our complaint line on these kind of complaints, otherwise being made more aware of their rights. My third point, just to be fair here, is that although this is the single largest area of consumer complaints, a couple hundred a year, and we checked the complaint statistics today, we're on track for another couple hundred this year. We've got 63 so far this year. That would come out to, if you do the math, about 200 for this year. There is no panacea in this area, because almost everybody that I know tends to think their car is worth more than it is, and so it's an area, probably no matter what we do in legislation, there will be some number of complaints. So we are not here to represent that this is the panacea and we won't have any more total loss complaints, but we believe that the use of public sources may give more credibility to the process. A lot of consumers do tell us that the estimates that they get, they don't really understand, and when they find out it came from somebody who's essentially only client for this kind of business, they have other kinds of business they've testified for, but for this kind of valuation business, the only client is the insurance industry, makes them skeptical. And so putting a public source in there, we think, would have a beneficial impact, unless, of course, almost all the time the public sources are giving a better number than their sources. If that's true, then there would be more complaints. But it all depends on that issue. And with that, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Joel, for being here again. And I just wanted to ask you quickly, what you helped work on the amendments. To your knowledge, the original bill exists, correct? Representative Buckley's bill.
Mr. Chair, it's Representative Gilliam. Yes, I believe it does exist. I believe, though, it's subject to the rule that it didn't get reported out of a committee by the deadline.
Representative Riley.
Thank you. Since I have the insurance person here, I wanted to ask, in this, is there any insurance company that offers car insurance that will guarantee to pay what you paid for your car if it's totaled?
Mr. Chair, there are provisions, there's a term for this, and Steve could probably give it to you, but you can buy a kind of insurance that allows you a kind of essentially a guaranteed price on value that would be used with like an antique car or that sort of thing.
Steve's still here. What's that called?
Stated value policy. He can explain it to you.
No, it's okay. I just want to know.
Well, Steve, sit down for a minute and state your name for the record and say stated value policy.
Fair Hope, members of the committee, again, Steve Merle with State Farm Insurance. There is a stated value policy that is primarily used for antique cars. It does do that.
Well, since you sat down and answered the question.
Damn, I can manage
you did, Jared.
Representative Riley, follow up.
So, can you buy that on any car?
Representative Riley, with State Farm, we don't do it on any car. I have heard of products that other insurers use that it's like homeowners products where you may have replacement value that you pay for.
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, instead of an old car, you get a brand new car. Mm-hmm. When you total it. I've heard of those products. I've not seen them. I don't know if there are any filings in Oregon for them or not.
Mr. Chair, I'm an expert on almost every filing, but not this particular one.
Okay.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about the A2 amendments. Online, do you have those?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, yes, I do.
And on line 10, it talks about how when the motor vehicle is totaled, the carrier shall determine the retail market value by using at least one source, and then the A and B combined, I think, is what you're referring to as the public source, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, that's correct.
And then down in line 17, it says the source or sources used has to be disclosed to the claimant. So does anything in this bill prohibit the insurance company from using all the other sources that they want to use? But under this amendment, they'd have to also look at least one public source.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, the intent of the bill is to say that the disclosure of the public source could be multiple public sources, not including non-public sources. But I see the direction of your question. You could read that to say that somebody could dump into Section 3 non-public sources. That's not the intent. Intent of number 3 is that those are the one public source or a combination of public sources.
Follow up. Then I'm trying to figure out, Mr. Aria, what the intent of is of the language at least one source in lines 10 and 11.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, the structure of the bill is in Section 2, you have to start with a public source, at least one public source. So it could be more than one. And then in Section 3, the intent is that one or combination of public sources be disclosed as a starting point for the discussion with the consumer. And then in Section 4, it allows the carrier to rebut those public sources through whatever means that they would want, including the CCC and the other services used today. So that's the structure.
Yes. Cheryl, Representative Bonamici, I think one thing that practically that you'd have to look at is that, and I think what you're getting at is, could we go ahead and give the public source and then use the tool we use anyway? The way that's written, I think you could. I think what you have to be concerned about is layers of expense, though. The initial value that you get will not come free. You'll have to subscribe to a service that gives you that value. And the question you're going to have is, okay, am I going to just give that value and work with that value, And that's going to be how we settle, or am I going to always have another expense where I go to the current tool and get another value and use that for negotiation? I don't think carriers are going to do that. I think they're going to, it's basically what you're going to do is you're going to set this up for book value negotiations, and that's going to be it.
Mr. Merle, does an insurance company only look at one source to determine the value of a car?
Chairman, we represent Bonamici. What we do, I can tell you what State Farm does. We use the Autotex product. Our claim representatives are empowered to look at the Autotex product and use their experience and judgment to make sure it makes sense. And before they ever call the customer, they're required to look at the data that came in from Autotex, the data that we gathered in the field, make sure they match up and reconcile them if they don't. And then their first step is to have that same process with the consumer. Because most of these problems come from differences. If you have problems, what my experience is, they come from differences in what you've identified on the vehicle. If you can reconcile it up front, you get a very accurate evaluation.
And Mr. Chair, one more follow-up. Thank you. And I'd like to ask both of you, and I'm sorry, I can't remember this from the prior testimony, a few things have happened since 2591. Have either of you done a comparison between Autotex or that type of service and the public sources you're referring to in terms of comparability?
Yeah, Chairman, we represent Bonamici. We have informally, we have within my office an individual who deals with property matters for the entire PAC Northwest zone. And one of the ways of checking how well these products work and is you have to say, okay, what would it be like if we use Brook? And they have done that. And that's study I told you that what we found out was globally we'd be about the same. But there are big variances where some cars are extremely undervalued using a book system and some cars are overvalued. And so you end up with a situation where you would have to do a lot more adjusting, a lot more talking if you go the book route than if you use the Autotex product.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, more or less agree with that. The point of the public source approach is that it is a rough averaging type of approach that may get more consumer confidence because you're using a more objective process. The current process that's used by most insurers, not all insurers, most insurers use one of the two basic services that they pay quite a bit of money for and into the billions of dollars nationally each year to do these very individualized assessments. But when you set up the expectation of the consumer that this is an individualized valuation of your specific car, that's where that notion of, you know, my car is worth more than other people think it is gets played into, and that we believe is the source of some of the complaints. If instead you have the public source approach, which is there's a law that says use the standard approach, which is what most people use most of the time, there's not even a market for individuals to go out and get these individualized valuations because they're way too expensive. By the way, the insurers could also get these for free off the web page. The public ones. Let me just finish. Maybe not. I believe nothing prohibits them from using a web page. But once you say to the person, this is the public source, here's how I used it, the thought is that for a lot of people, that will be persuasive, that will resolve the issue better, and you won't have these kind of notions of, well, where did the insurer come up with this valuation process and so forth. It's a simple, more transparent a process. But yes, clearly we would agree that in the whole and on the main, some people win, some people lose under this new scheme. Again, it's not a full panacea.
Yeah. Chair, Representative Bonamici, if I could respond to that. We cannot use a free web page. If you go to that web page, the terms of use is it's non-commercial. We would be violating the terms of use. Our law department has looked at that, felt like we would have liability if we were to do that. The valuation services concur with that, and because of that, we've instructed our people not to use that site. If we're going to use it, we use the business-to-business website, and we pay for it.
I appreciate that.
I have nothing to correct or rebut that, so it's probably correct.
And I see Mr. Miller calling his clients right now. So, with that, any other questions for these gentlemen? Appreciate your testimony on this. I have one just concern that this A2 amendment, I understand what has brought it forward. It,
it appears that there's not a consensus on this, of course. And I don't think we're going to incorporate that yet today, so I appreciate you coming forward and giving us all your thoughts on both the A2 and the regular bill. So,
Mr. Chair, we will continue to work the issue as they suggested. The issue is not going away, and so if we don't have a sort of sea change of this sort with the process, we will be continuing to work on some of the tweaks that we've do kind of on an ongoing basis with the current services.
Mr. Chair, can I ask one more question, please, before they leave? I'll ask it quickly.
Boy, I hesitated too long. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Merrill, what happens now if a customer calls and says, "Well, you're telling me my car is only worth $10,000, but I looked online and they tell me it's worth $15,000. How do you handle that?"
Chair, Representative Bonamici, what we tell customers is that we'll look at any objective data that they have, and sometimes, more often than not, because our people are very careful about checking out values before they approach a customer with the value. Our experience is, make sure you solve your own problems up front if you see there's something wrong with it and you have less problems on the back end. But what we tell them is we'll look at anything objective. More often than not, when we go to look at that, we may find some difference between the vehicle they're looking at. Or maybe the vehicle they're looking at is just way overpriced and isn't going to sell. Maybe it's been on the market for 120 days. And if the vehicle hasn't sold yet, that's one of the things people have to consider, because what you ask for and what you get in vehicles, that's one of these things in the United States that very few things that we actually negotiate, and I think people understand that.
Further questions?
Ken.
I can do without.
Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. I don't see anyone else signed up to testify on Senate Bill 523. Is there anybody else who wants to do that? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 523 and open a work session on Senate Bill 523A.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 523 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Bonamici moves Senate Bill 523A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, Mr. Riley, call the roll, please.
Representative Galizio?
Excused.
Representative Gillian?
Aye.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Riley?
Aye.
Representative Bonamici?
Aye.
Representative Nelson?
Excused.
Chair Holby?
Aye. Senate Bill 523A, having received the majority votes required, is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Anyone that wants to carry this bill, or should we put it on the consent calendar?
I'd be happy to carry it.
Let Galizio carry it.
Representative Gilliam will carry the day, or carry the bill.
Congratulations.
You may do
with that, I will close work session on Senate Bill 523.
Just to announce again.
And for those that are interested, we are carrying over Senate Bill 431A to Friday.
Can't we have Friday off?
Absolutely not.
You with are a slave driver.
With that, I will close, adjourn the committee on the House Consumer Protection Committee.
Yes, it's not.